You can say what you like about Johann Sebastian, but the bloke's a trooper. I mean, anyone else would, having heard the news, wouldn't feel like playing the theme. But Johann Sebastian, he's in there with his characteristic spirit. In case you missed the news, listener, a rogue asteroid is about to obliterate the planet in 72 hours' time. We're going to collectively kick the bucket in 72 hours. Now, we've decided to help us get through this small crisis in our collective lives. We're going to have a bit of a discussion on the end of the world.
Monster of monsters, big as a skyscraper. When he moves, the whole earth quivers and quakes, and an abyss of horror opens up. See these prehistoric beasts emerge from the bowels of the earth after 200 million years to devastate mankind. See Rodan destroy a modern city, leveling it to the earth with a killing airstream of his mighty wings.
It's alive!
A gigantic beast, Godzilla, king of the monsters.
Fantastic beyond comprehension. Can the scientists of the world find a way to stop this creature?
For the answer, see Godzilla, King of the Monsters, in a cyclonic cavalcade of electrifying horror.
They are in the grip of enormously powerful stories, fictions. We are all possessed by great myth and mythologies. There is a terrific mystery about being drawn to the abyss. You almost want to fall off. You lean over the edge, you look more and more closely. You even like the dizziness which may pull you over. There is something in us, very deep buried, which likes to think of catastrophe. The Greeks defined great tragedy, and it's a wonderful help, I think, by saying, you commit some irretrievable act with your eyes open. It isn't that you're muddled or that you don't know what will happen to you. No, eyes open, you get drawn into disaster.
Monster of monsters, bigger than a skyscraper. No, that's not a reference to Kerry Packer from a new documentary. It's a grab from Rodan, followed by a piece from Godzilla. And then the voice of George Steiner, the author of Death of Tragedy, talking about the dance of death we humans play with catastrophe, with disaster. And all of those were borrowed from a new film to be released next week, a fine film, incidentally, called The Sleep of Reason. I remember 20, 30 years ago writing a piece on Godzilla, suggesting that it has to be metaphorical for events in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and it was good to see them again. One of the reasons I love Godzilla and Rodan is because they're such wobbly monsters. The stop motion is so appalling. It seems to add somehow to their resonance. Now, the contemporary human fascination with conspiracy theories of all sorts, with doomsday prophets, with fear of disease and deadly uncontrollable viruses and moral and social decline, environmental degradation and destruction, all, of course, have a basis in fact and continue to persist. Perhaps they're necessary in some kind of way, or perhaps they can be attributed to the approaching end of the second millennium. During the same period in the first millennium, it seems humans also experienced the same phenomenon. They were just emerging from the effects of the plague, yet many people believed the end of the world was decidedly nigh. But the big difference between this millennium and the last is, of course, that today we actually possess the physical powers to destroy the world, or at least humanity's involvement therein. Now, in this discussion, I'd like to explore to what extent the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima 50 years ago really changed, in some fundamental collective sense, the way we feel about the world and our place in it, and what are the fears and fantasies about the world and its destruction that are bubbling below the surface today. Now, I'm delighted to be joined online from Melbourne by Peter Jordan, the producer of the aforementioned doco, to be released in Melbourne next week, called The Sleep of Reason. Also by an old colleague and friend, Father Paul Collins, Catholic priest, former member of the ABC hierarchy, and currently writing his next book. Online from California is Vivian Sobchak. Vivian is Professor and Associate Dean of the School of Theatre, Film and Television at UCLA, and her specialty, and I must say she does it very well, is science fiction movies. And finally, for our little doomsday gathering, online from Cape Cod, USA, is Robert J. Lifton. Robert, of course, Professor of Psychiatry and Psychology at the City University of New York, Director of the Center on Violence and Human Survival at the John Jay College. He's also the author of Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima, The Nazi Doctors, and his latest book, Hiroshima in America, 50 Years in Denial. I'm going to start with the humble Australian filmmaker first, with Peter. And I want you to tell me the truth, Peter. Your film ends in a marvellous way. It's a theme park, a fun park, if you like, in Hiroshima. It's a cold winter's day, it's bleak, nothing much seems to be working, there are very few people there, and a single roller coaster is eerily and rather sadly circling the place. And while we hear faint screams from a couple of Japanese people sitting in it, over the loudspeakers we hear, eerily I think, a version of Auld Lang Syne. Peter, tell the truth, you added that later, didn't you?
Well, yes, I added it later, but where I got the sound from was the amusement park in Hiroshima. They play, it's called Natalie, and they play at that amusement park a 1960s arrangement of Japanese arrangement of Auld Lang Syne at closing time every day.
Well, I think when you win your next award, and the film is destined to win a great many, I think you should send some part of that statuette to whoever does the music programming, because it was a marvellous and macabre ending to the doco.
It's documentary verite.
Now, Peter, what was your aim in making this glum, desolating, deeply depressing film?
Well, I hope that it isn't only depressing. I think it deals with some very depressing and very black parts of ourselves, but I hope that the film ends up not being so.
I think it's a wonderful film.
I know. Look, that's just in case some people out there took you at your word.
No one ever takes me at my word.
Oh, well, that's good.
Not a problem.
It started for me 10 years ago, really. I saw on the Channel 9 Sunday program here in Australia, then just released footage of Hiroshima that was shot by an American documentary team put together from among the best in Hollywood, who were sent in immediately after the Japanese surrender to record what they saw, what had happened with the use of the atomic bomb. And that film footage just struck deep into me somehow. And it was out of that, just looking at this landscape that looked like the desert at Cuba Pedy, but was once a city, and hearing really the silence, because it was mute footage, and seeing no one there, but for a few people picking through what was left of the city like a rubbish tip, and feeling that, and then just asking, like thousands of people before me, like everyone who I later found in the visitor's book at the Hiroshima Museum in Hiroshima, just puts the question, why, down. That came to me, and I asked myself, what is it about us that we do this?
Peter, I was delighted to see not only your interesting use of the Godzilla footage and your fascinating account of what happened at Trinity, you know, the first bomb test in Los Alamos, and also your explorations of that marvellous triglyph by Hieronymus Bosch. You also borrowed from a film which I think has almost been forgotten, called Children of Hiroshima, made, if I correctly remember it, by the school teachers of the town.
Yes.
And it has a marvellously Japanese way of dealing with the moment of the detonation. We see children in a playground, we see the shadow of the plane. Then there's a flash and we see a flower wilting.
Yes, yes, yes. That Children of Hiroshima was, as you recall, made in 1951 by the Japanese Teachers Union and is a neglected film. It tells its story through a young teacher who goes back to recall the Hiroshima she knew before the bomb, and she is there after the bomb and its story is told through a series of flashbacks as she remembers what she saw.
Well, I'm trying to give the listener a feeling for the film. It starts off at Coney Island. It ends, as I said, in the fun park, the rather glum fun park in Hiroshima. Yes. We deal with Bosch. We deal with a great many sort of metaphoric and apocalyptic images. And the film is loose and open. It gives you a chance to think for yourself. It's not too didactic. It's not heavily voice-overed. And I think it's simply marvellous, and I congratulate you on it. Paul, what were the main concerns? I know you weren't there personally at the time, but you have excellent connections with dead theologians. What were your main concerns of people at the end of the first millennium? What was going on then?
Well, Europe had reached the lowest point in its population. Actually, if you look at it from if you take the run from the Roman Empire through to, say, the 17th or 18th century, when the big modern growth begins, Europe in the 10th century was close to its lowest point, if not actually at its lowest point. The whole of central government had broken down pretty much. The Carolingian Empire, Charlemagne's empire, had not exactly collapsed. It had fallen apart largely because he had kept splitting it up according to the Frankish custom among sons. And so you had the kind of a multiplication of kingdoms, out of which, of course, comes our modern Germany and our modern France. It's the high point of the feudal system, so that the local thugs really take on lordly status and are really in control of the local areas. So it's a totally decentralized system of government. You've got recurrent plague, really bad problems with plague. The papacy reaches probably the worst point of its history in the 10th century.
Well, even worse than now, Paul.
Well, it depends on how you judge it, Philip. But in terms of moral behaviour, at least in the sexual area, and John the 12th, who was probably the worst of the popes, was recorded as having raped German pilgrims in St. Peter's. He didn't wait to get outside. It was, of course, a kind of almost like a mafia control of the papacy. The famous House of Theophylactus had taken over. There were a crowd from out of Rome who'd grabbed control of the papacy. And so it really was
a dark...
Sounds
like a time to sell your shares in the Vatican, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does, except that the interesting thing is right at the point of the turn of the millennium, with Pope Sylvester II, you have a kind of a revival. Probably the greatest scholar of the age was Pope at the time. He was... most people considered him a magician because of his great knowledge.
Could this just be around the corner for us now? Do you think in the new century such a marvel... this event will occur within the papacy?
I think, serendipity is part of history, certainly, Philip, but I'm not optimistic. The signs are not quite there, I'd say.
Okay, why is fear so much a part of religion? Is it an extrapolation from individual mortality to a larger screen?
I just think it is part of the human condition, and religion is one of those areas where, well, I suppose it's a little bit like psychology, it's one of those areas where, in fact, our fears are focused, because it provides the meaning structure for people. It's there that we are most fearful, because it seems to me that the difference between life and death, between staying alive and committing suicide, is often really at the deepest level whether you have a meaning structure or not. And so I think that religion, in a way, focuses meaning structure, and that's why people religious fear is part of it. I suppose it's also that kind of longing for continuity, a longing for something beyond this life, and a fear that it won't come, because part of the preaching of the time, and you certainly see this in the sermons of the time, is a fear of damnation, is the fear of death, especially violent death, which, of course, was very much part of the structure of society.
Okay, let's bring Robert in. Now, Robert, I must say the comments of George Steiner make sense to me. I believe that people are drawn to these images and these ideas like moths to the flame. How do you account for the way humans are so fascinated by the idea of catastrophe?
Catastrophe, I think, provides a kind of transcendence. And it does that, I believe, because it allows us to feel that we touch death, that we enter into an area that's ordinarily closed to us, and in a way that we rather systematically and extensively close out or numb ourselves to. I've often found in speaking about Hiroshima or Nazi doctors or one of the other grotesque subjects of my inquiries. Audiences are held to the subject and interested in it, and more than just interested. And if somebody comes on after that who talks about more routine, mundane matters, there's a kind of disappointment that's been expressed to me. There's a feeling of loss. There's a feeling that they had been touching something powerful, which they were then separated from. I think it comes down to some involvement with death at a dimension that we usually numb ourselves to. That if I were to try to answer in a single sentence, I would say something like that. But also important, as has been coming out in our beginning discussion, is some kind of promise of rebirth from the catastrophe, some sort of contrast between the destruction, the killing, and the dying, and the alternative of one's own continuing life, or the promise of renewal post-catastrophe, post-millennium.
Robert, in a minute I'll be bringing Vivian in, who can show us, demonstrate how we use cinema and popular culture to teeter on the edge of the abyss, to go back to what George was saying. But do you find that in yourself? Do you detect within your own psyche this dread fascination, this desire to look over the edge?
Well, I think it must be there for me to have undertaken the various studies that I have. For me, in looking over the edge, the issue of contrast is always important. People wonder why they hear me express hopeful ideas. My sense in immersing myself in the abyss, in engaging catastrophe insofar as I can, is that this is a hopeful act, because one is suggesting an alternative, contrasting the abyss and the destructive forces with the possibility of continuing life. So yes, some of that attraction is clearly in me, but it's held in contrast to my commitment to the continuity and fulfillment of life.
Robert, in for millennia, human beings have tried to find ways to deal with natural disasters and catastrophes. Earthquakes, tidal waves, volcanic eruptions, floods, fires, drought, famine, the list goes on. But of course, in this century, we've created a number of technologies that actually make catastrophe not only possible, but perhaps likely, and some would argue inevitable. And let's use the Hiroshima bomb as the symbol of our age, I guess, and also we've got to incorporate Holocaust. Has Hiroshima and Holocaust changed the world fundamentally for human beings forever?
Well, I think so. I think that with Hiroshima and Holocaust also, we took in the truth that from that time onward, we have the capacity to annihilate ourselves as a species with our own technology, by our own hand, and to no purpose. Of course, people who embark on such nefarious projects imbue them with purpose, but there's a recognition that all this could be done to no purpose, meaning that there wouldn't be that renewal or the rebirth that comes after the massive death so reliably in mythology and in mythological theory. Now we can do it once and for all, and by our own hand. That's a very new situation that bears some resemblance to earlier moments in history, even the flood, plagues of the Middle Ages, where one thought that the world was ending, because there existed religious motifs that could claim or could in some way encompass what was happening, and also they were seen to be occurring from outside, through a hand outside of our own. That's not the situation now. Our technology and our relationship to it, from Hiroshima in particular, but also from the Holocaust, changes the world and changes us.
You're listening to LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, via ABC Online and MP3. And this discussion exploring apocalyptic fears and fantasies was first broadcast in July 1995, before the entire planet was wiped out. My guests were Professor Robert J. Lifton from the Department of Psychiatry and Psychology at the City University of New York, former priest, now religious historian and writer, Paul Collins,
Australian filmmaker Peter Jordan, and Vivian Sobchak, Professor and Dean of the School of Theatre, Film and TV at UCLA.
Vivian, you're familiar with the documentary, I know, and you've seen the images that Peter conjured with his camera from the paintings of Hieronymus Bosch. Very prescient images, I would have thought, because as one looks at them, you are reminded of Holocaust, you're reminded of Bosnia, you're reminded of Hiroshima, for God's sake. All the images, in fact, seem to be conjured by the sort of imagination that makes the better science fiction films. So let's look at those as another method of teetering on the brink, you know, of looking into the abyss while seated in the comparative safety of a cinema. Talk to me about science fiction's direct relationship to the advances and the terrors of technology.
As well as its pleasures, I think. If I've been listening to the conversation so far, and I find it interesting in the fact that I would disagree with a lot of the things that have been said in terms of your initial question about, you know, apocalypse now, today, even in, you know, the time of Bosnia. And I'm speaking, of course, from the American context, where science fiction became a full-flown genre in the wake of the war, the end of the war, dropping of the bomb, and the Cold War, during the Cold War period. And certainly, you know, there is a sense in which one can track science fiction as a mapping of our relationships to technology as it enters the social sphere, and in both negative and positive ways. And I think one of the really fascinating things about the film, watching it again today in preparation for this broadcast, the ending in the Hiroshima amusement park with Auld Lang Syne. I would say Auld Lang Syne is ironic in the sense that I would question whether we have an apocalyptic imagination now. I think everything that Robert Lipton was saying about, in some ways, the apocalyptic imagination, the imaging of catastrophe in our paintings prior to cinema, but in cinema, and very specifically science fiction cinema, but also action cinema, that kind of engagement ultimately is hopeful because it's an attempt, even if it's displaced into these bizarre and sometimes tacky forms, is at least an engagement with some sort of fear and sense that there is the possibility of annihilation, of apocalypse on a grand scale. And right now, I think, you know, at least in the United States, apocalypse now means no health care. And it's linked to a present, and it's tied to a technology which is seen as not in a way evocative of what happened in Hiroshima in August, but indeed, you know, things that have to do with prosthetics, with downloading one's consciousness and leaving one's bodily meat behind, of cosmetic surgery. I think we do now feel we can get out of this world alive, and we don't have an apocalyptic imagination.
And indeed, Vivian, some of the science fiction films right through the Cold War and since have been euphoric and transcendental. If you look at, say, the cargo cult film of Close Encounters, you know, where humanity is going to be saved by the same sort of cosmic forces that in other films are out to destroy us, there's a sort of optimism about technology as well.
Yes, and there's also an acceptance. I mean, in 1960, Stanley Kubrick makes, you know, How to Stop Dr. Strangelove, How to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And ironically, while we may not have overtly loved, you know, come to love the bomb, we have, in a way, stopped worrying. Or the worries have become very sort of present tense, non-apocalyptic, localized. Their apocalypse now is reduced to Die Hard and Speed and, you know, survivable crashes and bomb blasts.
In which a characteristic and typical American hero finishes up winning, incidentally.
Absolutely.
And surviving,
absolutely.
Yeah. Let's get back to Paul, if I can, Vivian. Paul, what does theology have to say about technology? Does it view it with equanimity, or does it take a Luddite position?
Oh, I think you're probably giving theology far too high a grade here. It probably hasn't caught up with technology yet, but philosophy has. And I was just reflecting as Vivian was speaking, and also when Robert was speaking, it really seems to me that the person who has understood our situation best is Martin Heidegger. I mean, I hate to drag a Nazi in here, but Heidegger talks about technology. His discussion of it, it seems to me, is extraordinarily dense and complex. But what he seems to be getting at least it seems to me, is that technology has become a mode of being. It's a whole prism through which we view the world, and it's so much part of the very structure of our view of the world, of our very being, that we are unable to think non-technologically. He says it's not an ethical question, it's a metaphysical question. Now, I actually think that points very much to a millennial kind of sense, because here is something, exactly as Robert said, through which we can actually destroy the world now. It's not God or outside forces intervening to bring about destruction. It's actually in our own hands now, and yet we don't seem to have the wherewithal, not only the ethical wherewithal, but even the metaphysical wherewithal to be able to deal with it. So that Heidegger has a very apocalyptic view of reality, it seems to me.
So, of course, of a couple of recent American presidents who do manage to put theology back into the Cold War argument. You know, Reagan,
Philip,
with his evil empire, the idea
of... But Philip, a terrible theology. That's not theology, that's fundamentalist nonsense.
Robert, your book refers to the 50 years of denial of Hiroshima in America, which I guess we most recently and vividly saw with the fuss about the Smithsonian exhibition. So coexisting with a fascination for or in catastrophe is also a collective denial?
Very much so. You know, the very film that Peter mentioned earlier was suppressed. There were two sets of extensive films taken, one by Japanese film makers and the other by American filmmakers, both under the eye of the occupation, and they were collected and simply suppressed, kept in military and hidden archives, and only emerged in the last decade or two. And in that sense, Americans were denied images of what really happened in Hiroshima, and so was the world, not just Americans, particularly images of grotesque human effects. Now, this was a suppression of what we are calling the apocalyptic imagination. I agree that we need the apocalyptic imagination if we're to cope with our time. I see it in the new book I wrote, Hiroshima in America, together with Greg Mitchell. We talk about the need both for a measured self and an apocalyptic self. One needs both, and it's quite true. I agree with Vivian here that what's happening now is that we lack the necessary or appropriate fear or edge of anxiety that would contribute to a constructive expression of the apocalyptic imagination. And in that sense, we're not adequately protected from a very real threat that still stalks us. But I don't agree with the idea that this is all separate from immediate life-death issues. What we found in our center in interviewing, for instance, African-American poor, is that they were unusually articulate in imagining nuclear catastrophe because their very suffering, their very struggle simply to survive on an everyday basis sensitized and increased their moral imagination.
Robert, it became easy for them to extrapolate from their experience to this outcome.
Exactly, and they did it vividly and more intensely than any other group we interviewed.
Incidentally, I remember an Australian school teacher bringing to me drawings that kids of 5 and 6 had done in schools across this country, which seems to be a long way from northern hemispherical anxieties. And again and again and again, little Australian kids in this remarkably peaceful neck of the woods were drawing apocalyptic images. That's one of the things that happened in the Cold War, or as a result of it, isn't it? That these images did become global, irrespective of where you lived.
Oh, I think so. And even when they diminish consciously, as happened since the end of the Cold War, and again, we were doing interviews at our center as the Cold War was ending in the late 80s, and we could see that what had been a conscious fear became relegated to a sort of a shadow, pre-conscious, yet it was there, and what would happen would be that the apocalyptic images and fears related to nuclear threat would merge with those of environmental threat, and the way that the mind works, all sorts of apocalyptic events or potential apocalyptic events become merged in some sense of the fear of the end of the human project. That's still with us, even at the end of the Cold War.
Vivian, I was unsurprised by your the way you related Godzilla to Hiroshima. That had occurred to me as well. But where you did surprise me was with an observation that technology is the problem. In other words, it's a technology, in fact, gets Godzilla out of his ancient slumber. But technology is the answer, because it's only technology that can destroy the old bugger.
That's right. I mean, the films are very ambivalent when it comes down to it. I think bringing up Heidegger is very interesting, because we can't think outside of technology. Technology awakens these things and or mutates them, because there are all these mutation films where giant ants are about to get into the storm drains of Los Angeles, and the queen has to be caught before she lays eggs.
Oh, I thought that was a documentary. That's only a story.
It's an LA story, right? But I think it's interesting that in listening to Robert Liston. The whole issue of what's an apocalyptic imagination, with Hiroshima, it was a bang. It wasn't a whimper, and it wasn't something slow. It was an instant annihilation. Even with slow radiation death, we're still talking annihilation in a big way. And if you think about today, I thought it was interesting that Robert Lifton said we're not adequately protected, and that sounded like, something relating to a condom ad for safe sex. And we're really talking about apocalypse now in the form of a kind of seepage, virus, infection, AIDS obviously being almost interchangeable in certain ways with the way we relate to the technology of computers. And you see this in the contemporary science fiction films that are going to be coming out very shortly that are, if not out now. When one thinks about the atomic threat, it becomes more the kind of seepage of other Chernobyl than the Big Bang and its aftermath. So I think that there's this sense more of a kind of whimper, which one, again, like the earlier films, is looking towards technology to protect us. We're in a technological cocoon.
Well, let's go back to Father Paul and Heidegger and technology. Now, if Heidegger says that we're incapable of employing ethics with regard to technology, what does this say about humanity and the future, Paul? Because we've got to deal not only with the bomb, we've got to deal with genetic engineering, we've got to deal with artificial intelligence. There's an immense number of ethical problems that are being dumped on our table by technology.
Well, we've also got to deal with the question of environmental degradation, which might well be the worst of all, because it's actually a combination of at least a number of the things we've already mentioned. Well, Heidegger, quite frankly, is quite pessimistic about this whole thing. He doesn't exactly spell it out as the end, but he certainly says in this famous article in Der Spiegel, published 2 years after his death, he says, only a god with a small g can save us. And what he seems to mean by that is that it's only by a massive leap of our imagination whereby we actually break out of the constraints of our thinking. I mean, I really do disagree with Vivian that the technology is the answer. I mean, technophiles say that all the time, and you do get very...
No, that's not what Vivian says. She says that you see it is represented as the answer in popular culture.
Right, well, I apologize. I misunderstood you there, Vivian. Sorry about that. But, I mean, the technophile does bring that answer all the time. I actually think Heidegger says it's by poetizing, he says, which seems to me to mean that we have got to use our imagination in a massive way to be able to see our lives and our relationship to each other and to the world, the very fabric of the world itself, in a different way. And I mean, I think that the tragedy of our time is that we're caught in this postmodernist morass of particularities, whereby we simply can't even get above the particularity to see the bigger picture. That's why I say I think Heidegger is probably of two or three philosophers the most significant this century.
This is Classic LNL on ABC Radio National. You're listening to a discussion originally broadcast in 1995 about our apocalyptic fears and fantasies. My guests, former priest, now religious historian and writer Paul Collins, Vivian Sobchak, Professor and Dean of the School of Theatre, Film and TV at UCLA, the Australian filmmaker Peter Jordan, and Robert J. Lifton from the Department of Psychiatry and Psychology at the City University of New York.
Robert, some years ago I was asked to establish a government agency in this country with the Orwellian title of the Commission for the Future. And it was our task to get the community, the scientific community, the trade unions, the educators, the voters, discussing future options so that we didn't simply accept one that was delivered to us by the multinational corporation or the pressures of global politics. And we held a conference, which was a video conference, linking people right around the country to introduce them to an idea they hadn't heard about before, which was global warming, the greenhouse effect. And we brought out a couple of wonderful experts from the US. One of them was very apocalyptic and seemed to be arguing that the oceans were going to rise so fast that the Sydney Harbour Bridge would disappear. And the other had used different modelling and came up with a rather more modest prediction of a couple of inches. The feeling in the hall where I was in Melbourne was of enormous disappointment. The people there were angry with him for not giving us the flood. And it seemed to me that not only did this demonstrate that there was a quasi-religious fervour in the environmental movement, but people actually were willing the end. They wanted the end as some sort of judgment upon their humanity's sins. Do you detect that in your researches, this desire for calamity?
The desire for the ultimate calamity, for the end, does exist. But I think we learn in psychological work that fear and desire can readily coexist, often do. But I think the fear is greater than the desire. And what the disappointment in the example that you mention could have to do with a loss of the simplicity that people craved. It's still almost like a Manichaean universe that they're trying to create. If we can be certain that the end will come unless we do something wonderful, the world is laid out very sharply and we know where we are ethically. It's like the Cold War, you know. But as soon as one complicates it by shades of gray, well, there is this danger of global warming and we might have some lever on it if we're wise, and it may not really occur for the next few decades or whatever, that complicates the matter and ends the Manichaean certainties or ethical comfort, something like that occurring.
Robert, one of the things you've said, which I find intriguing, I'm not entirely sure I agree, but I want you to talk to it. You say it's easier to imagine the end of the world or the end of humanity than it is to imagine our own individual deaths.
Well, I'm not sure I said it exactly that way, but they are very much bound up. We die. The question is, what dies when I die? Is it just my sense of self, or does the whole world die? Really, as culture-creating animals, much of the whole effort of the evolution of human culture is to distinguish the individual and his or her death from the death of the whole. Because if something continues, if something goes on, I can more readily accept my death. When death is out of kilter, or life and death are out of kilter, I'm much more likely to associate my death with the end of everything. And then when atomic and nuclear weapons come along and posit the death event, as Edith Wishegrad puts it, that is the ultimate mass killing, as what we can expect, it becomes difficult indeed to distinguish individual death from the death of everything. And really, as long as we're struggling with death, I think that there's going to be some kind of end-of-the-world imagery. One of the things I said in the film is that we used to associate end-of-the-world imagery with either extreme mental aberration, such as schizophrenia, where it's very vivid in many cases, or with very particular religious projections. But actually, more and more scholars, more and more thinkers recognize that end-of-the-world imagery is integral to the human condition because we die, and our perpetual ongoing task is to distinguish the end of the self from the end of the world.
Paul, I'd like you to stand with me now in front of the Hieronymus Bosch painting, which depicts the end-of-the-world scenario so vividly. And I want to ask you this. Given that the Roman Catholic Church, among others, has brilliantly marketed the carrot and the stick, on the one hand, the inferno, on the other, the rather pristine and, I must say, deeply boring notion of heaven, which has been the most effective, you think, in keeping the troops in order? Has it been the fear of the apocalypse, or has it been the notion of transcendence?
I don't quite know the answer to that, Philip.
What's your feeling about it? I mean, the popular view is that people have been more afraid of hell than they were enchanted by heaven, that hell was a great weapon for the church. But it seems to me that it mightn't have been as simple as that.
Well, I think you may have to make a distinction. I mean, there's some interesting evidence. It's only just a tiny little research project that I heard about, and God knows how much breadth it has to apply to, you know, to world-scale kind of questions like the one we're discussing now. But it is interesting that it certainly seems that Catholics on questions of sexual morality have often made up their own minds for quite some time. There's some good evidence that they have, and they haven't taken very much notice of the Pope or the priest or the church's teaching. Now, it would certainly seem to me that on questions that touch the individual, people are often not moved by these kind of vast apocalyptic images of hell and threats thereof. However, I still think that they are very potent images, but because they play into our fears, because they really draw on things that are quite irrational within us and touch depths that that perhaps we're afraid to look at. But yet at the same time, that has to be balanced by saying that the preaching of God's love, of mercy, forgiveness, reconciliation, all these kind of things, I think also plays a part. So I honestly don't know that you can distinguish, that you can come down on one side or the other, because both of them appeal to different aspects of the human person. And both of them are potent in the way that people interact with those images. So I agree with you that the heavenly image is a boring one. You've only got to look at Dante's Inferno to see that.
Oh, well, sin has always been more photogenic, hasn't it, as every filmmaker or painter knows, and as Peter Jordan so vividly demonstrates.
You're listening to LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, via ABC Online and on your pod, and my guests for a discussion on apocalyptic fears and fantasies were, indeed are, Paul Collins, former priest, now religious historian and writer, Robert J. Lifton from the Department of Psychiatry and Psychology at the City University of New York, Peter Jordan, Australian filmmaker, and Vivian Sobchak, Professor and Dean of the School of Theatre, Film and Telly at UCLA.
Now, I'm going to go back to you, Vivian, with the reminder to you and to the listener that of the ambivalence of the apocalyptic science fiction movies during the Cold War era. For every film which had a sort of a Jungian proposition of destruction coming, you know, going to wipe us out, there was one, it seems to me, that was a bit more optimistic. I'm trying to remember the title of a film in which had a flying saucer landing in Central Park with Michael Rennie wandering out of it.
It wasn't Central Park. It was actually on the Washington Mall, Washington, D.C. Mall, and it was a rather anomalous film, actually. It was one of the very few non-xenophobic films made during the period.
Okay, right actor, wrong park. But he came to Earth, didn't he, in a sort of a messianic way to try and knock our heads together and to get us to cooperate.
Although it's a very Cold War and very detente in its whole solution to the problem of world war and enmity. The film is called The Day the Earth Stood Still, and it's very early. It's 1951. and Michael Rennie comes and is, as an alien, and is immediately shot by the military, which, you know, for bearing gifts.
That's what will happen with the Second Coming. He hasn't got a hope.
and the Second Coming is not out of line. It's really interesting, however wonderful the film is, and it doesn't browbeat you over the head with it. It has this incredible Christian subtext, and I am not, you know, one to read crosses into every window frame in movies. He comes. He takes the name. He walks among the people. He takes the name of Carpenter. He's betrayed.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. He takes the name of Carpenter. I'd forgotten that.
He's betrayed by a doubting guy named Thomas for a handful of you know, diamonds, and it goes on. He suffers little children to come into him, and he preaches. I mean, he truly is the Prince of Peace, but a Prince of Peace located very much of his time, because his solution is he comes with this threat of, you know, if you don't get your act together, human beings, and stop, either stop your petty squabbles in the face of your discovery of atomic power, we're going to blow you off the face of the earth.
Well, Vivian, there's a proud heritage here, because in a sense, and I'm trying not to see crosses in the window either, we had E.T., which had a similarly optimistic view, Close Encounters, which I think was also basically upbeat, saying everything can be okay. So I'm interested in, once again, the heaven-hell proposition.
Right.
Overwhelmingly, the images have been hellish, but there has been a consistent use of heavenly images as well, hasn't there?
Absolutely. I think particularly in the contemporary period, which in where you have films like Cocoon, where older people are rejuvenated and at the end of the film go off, as it were, to heaven instead of dying, although there's a sequel, so they have to come back. And, I mean, a colleague of mine, I can't remember whom precisely, wrote a really interesting article called Close Encounters of the Fascist Kind. In which, in fact, the kind of combination of the desire, you know, for some sort of transcendent moment is also, you know, combines this notion of something heavenly or extraterrestrial with, in fact, something that does go back to the day the earth stood still, that someone was going to come to tell us what to do. And I think that it's more shown as more benign now, but there's still that desire for something more, and it's very much there in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is one of the new, you know, the films in 1977, along with Star Wars, that really started this new, more benign light show trend towards looking at the sky with wonder.
It is now 72 hours to the great collision that's going to wipe us all out, and we're having a lovely, lovely chat here.
I want you to know. When Worlds Collide, also early. You mentioned the asteroids. You almost had it right.
But the most prescient science fiction artist, I think, is the one that Peter Jordan has rediscovered for us in Hieronymus Bosch.
Yes.
Peter, let's look at that painting in our minds. He has two bob each way, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Just where do you think he finally falls? He does hell so well, doesn't he?
Yes. Well, the pictures of hell are always more interesting. What he does, and what's little known about that painting, is, of course, that it's a triptych with the Adam and Eve panel, the famous Garden of Earthly Delights in the middle, and then hell as the other panel on the triptych. But the two outside panels of that painting actually close over the middle one, and what those panels show is it's all in black and white for some reason.
Very compellingly monochromatic, isn't it?
It's the lurid
Disneyland colours inside.
It's inside. Yes, it's an extraordinary choice. He does it in black and white, and they close to form a round globe of the Earth. There's a little medieval god up in one corner, presiding over it all, somehow directing it all.
But and Peter, doesn't this image suggest what Robert was talking about, a sort of a transcendental or the idea of renewal? Because it's cyclic.
Yes.
You can open and close that damn thing, can't you?
That's right. But you're never sure. You're never sure with Bosch whether it's a world that is in renewal after a flood, after destruction, because inside the globe is a flood. It's like a big goldfish bowl. Or it's the world on the third day of creation that's being created. And he leaves you with this extraordinary ambiguity. He leaves you with the paradox of that.
Well, Robert, that is the situation. We are left with a paradox and with ambiguity, aren't we? We've been obsessed in the century with end-of-the-world scenarios and hypotheses, but there's also, within human beings, as well as, I'm not sure about a death wish, but there's certainly within us an extraordinary rugged optimism.
You know, I was thinking about our heaven-hell dichotomy, as we've all been discussing in the last few minutes. One could say that you absolutely need depictions of hell, but you don't so much need them of heaven, and nobody quite knows how to make them, because nobody knows how to imagine sustained absolute pleasure, but lots of people can imagine sustained near absolute unpleasure.
Robert, that is absolutely spot on. How wise of you.
But I think that still in the depiction of sustained pain, that's the avenue to hope, because just bungling through, just surviving, which is what the human animal has been pretty much doing over all these decades and millennia, is an achievement, and we sense that. And we need the hell as contrast, not so much the heaven, but just kind of bungling through is enough. And that's where we are now, and we may just be able to do that still.
Vivian, Robert's right, of course, if you think about it cinematically. The numbers of films that have attempted to deal with a sort of a, with the celestial choir, if you like, with the post-mortal happy place, have been limited and incredibly banal, haven't they?
Absolutely. And right now on American television, there's a potato, a light popcorn commercial, sort of figuring some banal woman sort of getting ready to enter heaven. I mean, and that's the kind of reduction. It usually ends the movie. I think what Robert said is absolutely right. In many ways, I mean, hell has more significance for us. It's just a more, we're supposed to endure it forever if we end up there. And in a way, I mean, it parallels the worst in people's lives, and that's something they can't imagine. So I think he's absolutely right.
There's been a recent rash, of course, of films like Ghost and the appalling film that Paul Hogan, the Australian, made about Almost an Angel, a whole succession of films in which there is a survival after death and some sort of interaction. But basically, Hollywood has always gone down on the side of the apocalyptic images because they are so exhilarating. They're like the roller coaster, though, aren't they? You go up, you go down, you're into the abyss, and then
more dramatic. They're ultimately more dramatic. What is the dramatic curve when you're in heaven? There is this. There's the cutting. There's the special effects. There's the envisioning of all sorts of narrow escapes, and there's drama, which is drama connected to life and to suffering and pain, but there's usually not drama connected to heaven, which is interesting.
My guests for the discussion on the end of the world, and gosh, it was fun. I had such a good time that day, just before it all went black. Vivian Sobchak, Professor and Dean of the School of Theatre, Film and Telly at UCLA, Peter Jordan, Australian filmmaker, producer of the 1995 film The Sleep of Reason, and the very reasonable Paul Collins, priest, former priest and now religious historian and writer. Oh, and Robert J. Lifton, author of Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima and the Nazi Doctors. We'll have another classic for you at the same time next week, provided a giant hemorrhoid from outer space doesn't destroy us all. Meanwhile, coming up on ABC Radio National is the news, and we'll see you later.